Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today I'm on the beach with Nora Petrich, our sound engineer and editor, in front of the Northwest Maritime Center in downtown Port Townsend. My guest, Steve Grace, a local naturalist, is out on the water snorkeling. In a few minutes, he'll come ashore for a conversation about what he's seeing around the old breakwater pier and in the nearby eelgrass beds. Until then, let's hear this week's mystery sound. That recording was sent to me by Wendy Feltham, a local naturalist, photographer, and friend. She made the recording earlier this summer near the intersection of Cook and Hastings. Well, during these COVID-19 times, many of us have been getting outside for walks and just to be in nature. But group gatherings, such as bird watching and native plant outings, Natural History Society hikes, and many citizen science projects have been canceled. In lieu of actually getting together, many local naturalists have been having some fascinating, multiple far-ranging email conversations. I want to relate one of the recent exchanges that began with various insect observations and then quickly moved on to a discussion of the many sightings of butterflies, especially swallowtails, on scat, usually the wetter leavings of birds and mammals. Varn Brooks shared a photo of butterflies feasting on goose droppings at Anderson Lake. A lively discussion ensued about why were the butterflies getting nutrients, minerals, salts, water. We do know that bird and mammal scat is especially rich in nitrogen and salts, especially on the outsides. Daryl Smith, a local mammal expert, observed that butterflies are phylogenetically, and that means sort of evolutionarily, quite distinct from vertebrates. So he would expect that the gut microbes present in the vertebrate scat would pose little threat to insects. Daryl went on to observe that mammal scat has a mucus coating, which could be nutritious, as well as contain a good amount of moisture when fresh. Of course, as an aside, mucus is a truly marvelous phenomenon, critical to many, many groups of animals. Well, the email conversation finally ended with folks wanting to look closer. Were the butterflies basically running their mouth parts across the surface of the scat, lapping up minerals and water? Were the butterflies able, or not, to penetrate into the rich, nutritious insides? Were the insides being left for critters such as slugs and maggots? Well, that's the scoop on poop. Steve Grace has just come out of the water. Let's see what he has observed. Steve is all outfitted in a wetsuit because he has been snorkeling this morning. So, Steve, I first want to know, my impression of this water is it's really, really cold. Tell me, were you really, really cold out there?
No, you know, I just got out of the water, Nan, and I feel great. I have my wetsuit on, but the truth is, on a lot of days, I've actually been going without the wetsuit. I've realized that I can get away with just a pair of shorts and a snorkel and a mask, and away I go. And
that's completely mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. I know, it was shocking to me, too. Before I moved here, I heard that people went scuba diving in the Salish Sea, and I thought, that's crazy. Why would you do that? It's cold. It's just like
soupy
green water.
Yeah, I sort of feel that way about it, yeah.
But then I heard this rumor that Jacques Cousteau, this was one of his favorite places in the world to dive, second only to the Red Sea. I thought, well, there must be something going on there. What's happening beneath the waves?
So you do the mask, snorkel, flippers, and a wetsuit if you need one. That's amazing to me.
Yeah, you know, and you don't have to go very deep. You don't have to make it very complicated. I don't have a weight belt with me today, so
yeah.
I'm not diving down deep.
Right.
And sometimes I'll go in and just be in water that's, you know, maybe no more than 6 feet deep, places that I could actually stand up if I felt like I was in trouble or nervous, and I could just literally just stand up. So it's really accessible to anyone. Even if you're not a strong swimmer, there's ways you can get in there in just a few feet of water.
This is a pretty sheltered area. It's a little overcast today, but it's not windy. For our listeners, as we started, I mentioned we're down here on the beach in front of the Maritime Center. We're sort of over towards the east of it along an old pier. Actually, I want to ask Nora, do you remember what this beach used to look like? So, you know, it's sort of a pebble with a few boulders here and there and then these piers.
I think the beach looks pretty close to the way it looked 40 years ago. Well, except for the boulders that are now sitting on the beach that used to be inside the breakwater. We used to come down here a lot from the sail loft. It was our favorite lunch spot, and we would go swimming and take our breaks out here, and it became known as Sail Loft Beach.
Sail Loft Beach.
Yeah.
That's a new one for me. Thank you. So tell me, as you went in, did you go along the pier? Did you see what's growing down there?
Yeah, so I like this area because there's a couple different ecosystems here. There's some, so we've got this old pier here, like you mentioned, and this is basically like a rocky reef habitat. It basically sort of substitutes for rocky reef. So you have all these organisms that need to attach to a solid surface. So right now we're looking at acorn barnacles, we're looking at blue mussels, and all sorts of other critters and creatures that need to be on these solid surfaces. There's also a beautiful macroalgae forest out there, a beautiful kelp. There's some eelgrass. And then you have different animals associated with each of these different ecosystems. And this is a nice area where they all kind of overlap. So you have the eelgrass, you have the macroalgae forest, and you also have this sort of rocky reef habitat. So there's a lot going on here. There's a lot to see in a very small area.
So let's talk about the eelgrass first. I know we're in an area that is sort of a volunteer no anchor zone for the eelgrass, and you can see those floats offshore a bit that kind of mark the area. If I were paddling around out towards there, what would I see?
Yeah, so from the top when you're paddling around, you'll see, you know, at low tide you can see those eelgrass meadows, and they're just big verdant, you know, bright green, kind of lime green. It can be quite beautiful, but it's much more beautiful to get down there in the water and to actually swim through them. The way the light strobes off the blades of eelgrass is extraordinary. It's a flowering plant, which some people may not know. So it's very, very distantly related to kelp or to algae. You know, this is a flowering plant that evolved on land, went back into the water. Sometimes you can see the pollen coming out of the flowers. It's like a yellow dust. When it's photosynthesizing, it's quite beautiful because it releases silvery bubbles of oxygen. And you can kind of ruffle the blades a little bit and get those to release. And there's sort of this effervescent, bubbling, champagne-like explosion of bubbles. And there are myriad creatures attached to those eelgrass blades and living in the eelgrass meadows. One of my favorite is the stalked jelly.
Oh, I love the stalked jelly. Tell us about the stalked jelly.
Oh, they're so much fun. Okay, I'm so glad you asked. I'd love to talk about the stalked jelly. Okay, so these are a jellyfish, which most people are familiar with, or scientists like to call them jellies, jellyfish. This one stays in place. It doesn't float around like we're used to seeing, like other jellyfish. It has a stalk, and with that stalk, it attaches to a solid surface, often a blade of eelgrass.
And I sort of think of it, if you take a jellyfish and turn it upside down, and then grow a stalk from the bell, that's...
Nice.
Yeah,
and its body is almost shaped like a little wine glass.
Yeah.
And then it has eight arms, and at the end of those long arms are tentacle explosions. They look like little firework explosions or little pom-poms. And what I just learned recently, and I learned this through watching, this is an example of something I never would have seen. I don't think I would have seen this in a tide pool, but I saw it when I was snorkeling the eelgrass, and I got patient and just kind of floated in place and watched for a while. And I saw stalked jellies actually moving on the blades of eelgrass. So they're not completely stuck in place. What they can do is release their grip with that stalk. They grab on with their little pom-pom tentacle explosions, and they flip over, they do a somersault and attach their stalk again. And they somersault their way up or down a blade of eelgrass. I don't think I would have seen this if I hadn't been snorkeling in an eelgrass
meadow.
I've
never seen it. I've seen samples brought ashore to look at. Oh, this is gonna, you're gonna convince me to go snorkeling pretty soon. So, of course, eelgrass beds are also great places for nurseries or refuges for forage fish. What did you see out there this morning?
So exactly, that's such a great point. They're critical nurseries for things that most people care about, like Dungeness crabs and salmon, right? Juvenile salmon spend a lot of time in eelgrass nurseries. Today I saw some herring. Herring are also absolutely dependent on healthy eelgrass meadows.
Okay, give me an idea. How long?
So a herring, maybe a few inches long. You know, you think kind of like your thumb, okay. Maybe a little bit bigger than that. And, you know, a lot of people know about herring or forage fish. We kind of think about them in the abstract. We know that they're critical links in the Salish Sea ecosystem. They join the smaller things like zooplankton to the larger things like salmon, and then the orcas eat the salmon. And so the forage fish are this absolutely critical link, and we kind of know they're silvery, sort of minnow-looking things. What I didn't understand is they are incredibly beautiful and vibrant and really fun to swim with. And I love nothing more than getting in a school of herring and watching them. At first, they're sort of a loose shoal, and when there's some kind of threat, when they feel nervous, they gather together in a school. They start moving in one direction, and sometimes you can sort of swim with them and become part of that school. And where I really got hooked on snorkeling, Nam, was right here, just a little ways out from this pier, not very deep water, but I got in the middle of a swirling bait ball of herring.
Oh, my.
Last summer, I thought I was in a David Attenborough documentary. It's incredible. So the herring schooled up around me and started moving, and I realized that fish were coming in to slash at them. Some kind of salmonid. I think maybe they were juvenile Chinook, maybe sea run cutthroat trout, but they started slashing at the herring. The herring got in a tighter and tighter ball. They started circling around me in this whirling silver spear. And birds came from above. I could hear chattering kingfishers. Guillemots were whistling. Rhinoceros auklets came to join the party. And then seals came up from underneath and started hitting that swirling bait ball
herring. And you
were
right in the middle of that.
I was in the middle of it. It was extraordinary. I thought, this is incredible. It's right near shore. This is easy to do. I didn't spend much money to get a snorkeling mask. And it's all right here. And anyone can go witness that.
So let's talk about birds for a minute. I mean, I'm used to sort of spotting birds, identifying at least some of them, up here on land, and I know there's some pigeon guillemots over there. Of course, we heard the gulls, probably a belted kingfisher. From the perspective of snorkeling, what views into the bird world do you get?
Yeah, so thanks for asking that. That's been one of the biggest surprises to me, and a really pleasant surprise. I feel like, you know, I knew a fair amount about seabirds in the past. I've learned about them. I've even taught about them. But I feel like I didn't really understand seabirds until I was under the water with them, because that's where they really evolve to be at their best. And sometimes we see seabirds flying in the air, and they look kind of clumsy.
Right,
you know, they have a lot of trouble getting started.
Yeah, some of them are really clumsy.
They crash, they crash land, like the pigeon guillemots. Here we see them just sort of this uncontrolled crash landing into
the
water.
Surface,
So they get by in the air, they can fly. But when they're underwater, they swim with such elegance and such power. It's a beautiful thing to see. And they have this trade-off where to become really powerful divers and swimmers, they're not as, you know, quite as adept at flying. And so when you see them in their element, they've evolved to go under the water, and not only to swim well, but to swim better than fish that evolved in water. That's an extraordinary thing. Some of them will catch, you know, chase down fish, catch multiple fish. And the first time I saw a bird underwater was a horned grebe, and it came by me at incredible speed, just blistering speed, chasing after fish, after surf perch. And I think there was surf perch. It was all happening so fast, and it was sort of covered in this coating of silvery quicksilver, shimmering bubbles, and moving at extraordinary speed and turning on a dime with just absolute precision.
Wow.
And I was hooked. I thought, this is incredible. And then I saw some alcids. I saw pigeon guillemots underwater, rhinoceros auklets, and I feel like I really didn't get seabirds. I didn't have the level of appreciation I should have until I was in the water swimming with them, seeing what they do best in their element.
So what's the most exciting bird experience you've seen?
That would have to be a common loon, seeing a loon under the water. Because loons, you know, the word literally means clumsy.
Yeah.
Right? And they are clumsy in the air. They're notorious for sometimes they have to take up to a quarter mile to get started to get off the water.
Yep.
Right? But when you see them underwater, holy cow, are they efficient and powerful? I saw a loon swim by once, and they do this thing where so loons are kicking with their feet. You know, alcids like pigeon guillemots are basically like paddling their wings when they're underwater.
Flying through water or something.
Flying through the water. Yeah, literally flying through the water. A loon's kicking its feet, and to turn, it sticks out one foot and turns. It can just pivot around 90 degrees. Like a rudder, yeah. So that was really cool to see. So yeah, that's, to me, it's going into the water snorkeling is as much about birding as it is about looking at fish and sea creatures. That was a big surprise to me.
Yeah, that's a surprise to me. I, Yeah.
So leave the binoculars at home if you want to go birding and get in the water and check out seabirds.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, Steve, this seems like a great place to snorkel. Where else around here have you snorkeled, and what kind of different ecosystems can you sample?
Fort Worden's great. You know, there are a lot of good spots there. Right around the pier at the Marine Science Center is just phenomenal because you have some really healthy, vibrant eelgrass meadows there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some nice macroalgae, and you have all those pilings underneath the pier that serve the purpose of sort of rocky reef habitats. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of creatures attached to those. That's an extraordinary place to go. There's also a really nice sandy beach there to haul out on.
And warm back up.
Yeah, get warm back up. So that's definitely a great spot. I go in Discovery Bay a lot over where I live. That's not much rocky habitat there. That's more eelgrass meadows. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many good spots. Just about anywhere you can get in the water here, anywhere there's public access where you can legally get in the water, get down to the water and get into it, I would encourage people to go. But yeah, those are good places to start, right here at the Northwest Maritime Center and over at Fort Worden. Pretty good spots. The really warm places. I was at a Hood Canal can get extraordinarily warm.
Right.
I've been there and, you know, in a swimsuit and been in a mask and snorkel and been in the water, you know, for a couple hours sometimes and stayed warm. Discovery Bay, too, especially on minus tide days, I'll go not at the minus tide, but I'll wait till the water comes back in. And then it heats up because the land is heated up. So when the high tide comes in, I go out and snorkel on a few feet of water in Discovery Bay in the late afternoon. It's really nice. I just run from my house. I got a pair of running shoes on and mask and snorkel in my little pack and just run down and take a swim. And
it's a great visual image.
I don't wear my snorkel and mask while I'm running. That would
maybe
be a little too strange of an image. So Hood Canal is a place called Broad Spit where I went a couple years ago, and I was just absolutely astounded at
where
how warm
that?
It was. I mean, it was like tropical. I thought I was in Hawaii. I thought, how can this be? I went on a friend's boat, and it's just, it's somewhere out in, you're nodding vigorously, Nora. You've been there. It's a cool
Nora
spot,
knows
right?
where it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I know Broad Spit. I sailed down once, and I think it was about 20 years ago. It was myself and four little kids. We pushed off from Hadlock and sailed under the Hood Canal Bridge and came down the canal and up into Daybob. So Broad Spit actually sits in Daybob Bay, and I believe that it is a county park, but you can only access it by boat. And then, of course, there are the trespassers.
We don't want to encourage that.
So
that might be a little logistically complicated. But again, if people want to just sort of get their feet wet, so to speak, Northwest Maritime Center and Fort Worden, Fort Flagler has some nice spots there, too. So those are all good places to start and kind of get a taste of it.
I was also wondering, have you ever snorkeled at Shine at the beach there?
No, I haven't, but that's been on my list. I'd like to.
That seems to me like it would be an interesting place.
Yeah, I know people that have. I've seen photos that people have taken from there. Looks like a good spot for sure.
Okay, Steve, you're getting me real close to wanting to do this. We've talked about a lot of things. Are there other animals or plants out there you've seen that you just kind of make sure you want to share with listeners?
Thanks for asking, because I would be remiss in not mentioning the jellyfish.
Oh, yes.
Or the jellies, as the scientists like us to say. The first time I saw a moon jelly in the water, and that was actually here at the pier that I swam with one,
they are beautiful.
They are beautiful, and it's so different from, you see one on the shore, and they're kind of this blob that doesn't look very appealing, very interesting, very charismatic. But they have what's called a hydrostatic skeleton. So they don't have bone, they don't have cartilage. They need to be in the water to form their body, to give it shape and to give it function. And when you see them in the water, they're completely different, and they are so beautiful. And the way that they pulse their bell is absolutely mesmerizing. You know, there's great science that shows that watching fish, many studies have shown that watching fish has tremendous health benefits. It lowers blood pressure, reduces stress, elevates mood. This has been demonstrated again and again in studies.
All those things we all need.
That we all need right now in this time, right? I mean, now it's more important than ever. And so watching jellyfish, I feel like, is even the next level. Mm-hmm. Like watching fish, I definitely feel my heart rate go down. Yeah. I feel calm. It's almost like a form of meditation. When I get in a smack of jellyfish, right, a school of jellyfish is known as a smack. When I'm right in the middle of a smack and they're all pulsing, and sometimes it almost seems like it's synchronized, and I feel like my heart rate drops down and matches
so
their pulsing. So mesmerizing.
So the moon jellies, they're a big dinner plate size.
Yeah.
And they've got sort of, you know, white moonish. And they've got four white, they're kind of lopsided circles.
Right, yeah, almost like horseshoe shapes.
Yeah, that, or, yeah. I mean, that's how I identify them. Yeah, and those, I think those are the reproductive organs.
Exactly, yeah.
So what other kinds of jellies?
Yeah, so my favorite, well, earlier this year we had a lot of crystal jellies and also cross jellies, which are really cool. And those have some bioluminescence, so that's something you can do. You can swim at night with them, and, you know, if you kind of touch them, sometimes you can trigger the bioluminescence. Mm-hmm. But my favorite is the lion's mane jellyfish, the largest jellyfish in the world. And they have long trailing tentacles. The moon jellyfish's tentacles are very fine, almost hair-like. They're hard to see. But the long trailing tentacles of a lion's mane is extraordinary. And that color, there's sort of a deep maroon. And it's almost like they're glowing from within when you see them in the water. And watching those things pulse and being near them when they pulse is, again, it's mesmerizing, it's enchanting, and there are definitely some good health benefits there. There's some great relaxation to be had by watching swimming with jellyfish.
Steve, have you ever seen the jellyfish feed?
I don't think so. I've definitely looked at what's called their oral arms, and those are sort of the long, frilly appendages that hang down below their body. And sometimes you can see like little creatures stuck to those, like maybe little copepods or amphipods, things like that. I really love looking at the fried egg jellyfish because it has a really mild sting, and a lot of creatures live in association with it. So a lot of times you'll see like little copepods on it. You see amphipods swimming around it or among its tentacles, even little crabs and little fish, which it may be feeding on, or they may be sort of immune or resistant to its sting. So it's almost like this entire floating ecosystem. It's like this whole world, this sort of planet drifting through the ocean void. So it's fun to swim after those and try to figure out what's going on there. Who's eating whom?
Yeah, who is eating whom? And I was sort of thinking, jellyfish are upside down, sea anemones or sea anemones are upside down, jellyfish, however you want to look at it, they are related. And I pretty much assume that the jellyfish feed in a very similar process. They probably have the nematocysts or the stinging cells, and they probably bring those lobes up into their central mouth. And I've certainly seen it in an anemone, but I've never seen it in jelly.
Yeah, well, there you go. Now you have to go snorkeling to report back.
Right.
We'll do a whole show on jellyfish feeding. You can report your observations.
Right. Okay, I'll put that on my to-do list. Well, Steve, this has been a wonderful conversation down here by the water, and you've inspired me, and I hope you've inspired others. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Nan. Thank you, Nora.
Oh, that was fun. Let's hear our mystery sound again. Although some people may find this cry of a baby coyote unsettling, or perhaps even scary, I must admit that to me, it is a sound that some wildlife are continually finding ways to coexist in a world constantly changed by human activities. And unlike wolves, coyotes are strictly monogamous. During the pregnancy, the male frequently hunts alone and brings food back for the female. At first, the pups are dependent entirely on milk. The parents begin supplementing the pup's diet with regurgitated solid food after a couple of weeks, and by the age of 4 to 6 weeks, pups are given small food items such as mice or rabbits. The male plays an active role in feeding, grooming, and guarding the pups, and there's usually 5 or 6 pups per litter. The pups are up and running around 6 weeks, and then the den is abandoned by late July. And the pups follow their parents in patrolling the territory and hunting. And that baby that Wendy Feltham recorded clearly was in a den in the woods near Cook and Hastings or in Cappy's Trails. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays after the community resources and calendar, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9, Thursdays at 5 p.m. after the local news, and Saturdays at 12:30. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. Today's ending music is Octopus's Garden. That was on the Beatles' 1969 album, Abbey Road.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see an octopus's garden with me. I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden in the shade. We would be warm below the storm, in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our head on the seabed, in an octopus's garden near a cave. We would sing and dance around, because we know we can't be found. I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden in the shade.